we are ready to go, and I'll probably get it wrong, but he's the Associate Director of the Center for Evolution, Ethics and Religion in West of God in the United States, and we do want him here to Edinburgh, and he's going to speak to us about the problem of looking after our planet.
Augustine's affirmation that thou hast made us for thyself, and the heart is restless, shall it find its rest in me. Jesus' statement that man shall not live off bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, and the psalmist's affirmation that my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. The nearness of God is my good. These aren't collectively called proof texts for this notion. These are representations of broad commitment in the Christian tradition to the notion that who we are materially as organic beings, is somehow fitted for belief in God. And one implication of scientific approaches to understanding religion might be that we could think of it in terms of describing the contours of Pascal's vacuum. On the other hand, recent theories have represented a move in faith diminishing, not faith enriching tradition in several ways. First of all, there's a focus exclusively on its origin in human nature to the disregard of its foundation in reason. Now, in part, this may be due to the fact that this is what science does. It can't evaluate metaphysical arguments, but it can do the latter. It's not only due to that fact. In his recent work, Religion and Naturalism, the philosopher Kai Neil says this: by now, it has been well established that there are no sound reasons for religious belief. There is no reasonable possibility of establishing religious belief to be true. There is no such thing as religious knowledge or sound religious belief. But when there are no good reasons for religious belief, and yet religious belief that is both widespread and tenacious, persists in our cultural life, then it is time to look for the causes of belief. That is to say, if religious belief isn't rationally defensible, then the only thing left is to look for mechanistic causes of why people would believe such things. Secondly, not only is there a disregard of the foundation of reason, but specifically in evolutionary theory, there has been an attempt to collapse human reason into natural selection. In his book, Creation of Cell, Dan Dimmitt begins with this observation: everything we value, from sugar and sex and money to music and love and religion, we value for reason. But lying behind is distinct from our reason, our evolutionary reason, free-floating rationales that have been endorsed by natural selection. Now, this isn't a science-religion debate. Actually, this is a debate right now within the natural sciences, and that is involves the extent to which human reason can be understood exclusively in terms of evolutionary reason. And then, of course, if all human reason can be understood within the context of evolutionary reason, we have a profound problem, a epistemological problem with Warren, and why should we believe evolution at all? Dimmitt's claim, and Dawkins' claim, is that religious reason can be understood purely in terms of natural selection. To put this in terms of the language of game theory, for those who are interested in this, this claim would be that human utility, which in the discipline of behavioral game theory, can be reduced to evolutionary utility in terms of the payoff of natural selection. And lastly, what represents this new naturalism is that it involves an equating of organic rootedness with function, with origin. And by that I mean this, that any idea, religious or otherwise, may have find a hospitable soil in human cognition to take root. And having taken root, it may involve, it may bestow a functional advantage or adaptation on the believer. But to attribute organic rootedness or function to describe organic rootedness or function is not to say anything necessarily about its origin. There are questions of metaphysics here. Origins might ultimately be the transcendent, but there are questions of evolutionary science as well. One of the problems in evolutionary theory, and interestingly, this has been pointed out for several decades by creationist critics of evolution, is to describe the function of a particular characteristic doesn't necessarily describe its origin. And this is the Paley-Garvin debate. In his last great book, Stephen Boole said, "A crucial but often disregarded distinction between reason, historical origin, and basis of current utility. The common conflation of these entirely separate versions has engendered enormous confusion and evolutionary theory. So I want to suggest that these three things together form a package of a kind of a new naturalistic approach to religion, which is this method, and again, Kai Nielsen teaching this kind of naturalism, argues that all naturalistic explanations are incompatible, where accepted, with the person who accepts it continuing to be a religious believer. Naturalistic explanations of religion would, widely accepted, destroy religion itself. Now, this is not to say that scientific explanation reasonably constrained is the enemy of religion. In fact, I'm going to argue in many respects, it's the friend. And what I want to do with the time remaining again is, first of all, make a few comments about naturalistic evolutionary explanations of religion that set the landscape. And I think we're going to talk this afternoon on Nancy Murphy may approach this with more philosophical acuity than I will. Secondly, I want to survey a number of the major evolutionary proposals for religion and then close with some brief comments on implications for faith. So naturalistic explanations of religion, I mean, first of all, involves an explanation that's natural. It's not really clear what that means. What many evolutionary biologists mean without much philosophical assessment is just that it's not a supernatural explanation. So in a recent article, the Chicago evolutionary biologist, Jared Coyne, simply affirmed that evolutionary explanations are not supernatural and they don't involve any supernatural entities. There are a number of problems with, of course, supernatural just means not natural. So there are a number of problems in defining something in terms of it not being what it's not. But the history of supernatural demarcation is itself permeable. So Newton's theory, to begin with, gravity was believed to be an occult force. It was questioned at the time. Perhaps a more helpful way, although also problem-driven, would be to just affirm that natural explanations involve observable regularities and testable causal relations. Now this, too, at least in terms of establishing the biology as opposed to physics, has raised a number of problems. So there are a number of philosophers of biology who are arguing, well, if we take this seriously, does it allow the attribution of a function, or is that not a testable causal relation? One step up, does it allow the notion of mentality as a causal basis? But when applied to religion, we kind of take this as our take-home approach. If we want to provide a naturalistic explanation, it's an explanation that does not employ the objects of religious belief in causal account of those beliefs for their attendant affect. In other words, we don't employ the existence of God in the causal effect of why people believe in God. Now, if we do that, we're bound to make the mistake where God has a role in those beliefs. But maybe, even within the context of the Christian affirmation, Paul in Romans 1, for example, maybe there are some beliefs which God has deposited in us by nature. And I should say that this doesn't assume the falsity or emergence of what it believes in. Not employing it in a causal account doesn't mean there is no God. And doesn't mean that if there is a God, he doesn't do miracles, or doesn't act in some way. Just means that we're agreeing not to employ that in an explanation. Now, even within the sciences of evolution of religion, there are some questions that this raises. First of all, we don't employ the objects of belief in a causal account of belief. That's a little strange, isn't it? I believe that John Polkinghorne is sitting there in that chair, and to not employ the fact that John is in the chair in a causal account via my retinal cognition of why I believe that is a little strange. Now you might argue, okay, but religion doesn't involve belief in things that can be seen. But I also believe that the text Pythagorean theorem is a viable proof of determining the size of a triangle. And that's actually not the there's an internal logic. And Dan Dimmick, the integration itself, says in order to explain the whole, that various religious ideas and practices have on people, we need to understand the evolution of the human mind. Well, in one sense, that's true, but Kant wouldn't say that of the Pythagoras view. He would say, in order to explain the whole that Pythagoras has in people, we need to understand the evolution of the human mind. One of the problems here is that we may need to distinguish between the evolution of the natural explanation of the passage and the explanation of the content. So it may be that we could come up with an evolutionary story for the capacity to believe in transcendent or supernatural reality, but would not explain necessarily the content. Here's a second question. Again, asked within the universe. This commitment to neutrality, is that a good commitment? Neutrality with respect to the truth or falsity of religious beliefs. And on the one hand, it seems like a very good commandment. It preserves the tremendously fruitful, broadly shared methodology with science. And secondly, just the teaching protocol. Anthropologists have long learned that if you want to know why people do or believe what they believe, you should go into it. You're saying you want to understand why you believe these stories. So there are arguments for neutrality, but there are arguments against neutrality. For one thing, the qualities of the explananda, what is to be explained, justifiably influence the explanation. So again, I'm sorry to pick on John here, but if John Polkinghorne says he's John Polkinghorne, I will come up with one kind of explanation for why he would think such a thing. If I say I'm John Polkinghorne, you're likely to come up with other kinds of explanations for why I would believe such things. So I call this the Miracle on 34th Street syndrome. I don't know in the UK if this movie made a dig, but it's a big Christmas movie in the US, and it put somebody who really believes their Santa Claus on trial for insanity. But there are all sorts of political problems. And so at one time in the movie, the judge, the defense attorney says, I intend to prove that my client really is Santa Claus. And the judge says, okay, this court will keep an open mind on the existence or non-existence of Santa Claus. But in science, it's not clear that we should keep an open mind to things that are obviously there. The problem is distinguishing between which there are and which are not. Secondly, in some evolutionary accounts, the very fictitiousness of belief is not something to be explained, it actually figures in to the explanation. The fact that people believe things which are clearly demonstrably false turns out in some evolutionary accounts to figure into the explanation. So there are arguments against neutrality. I close this little section with asking, if we consent to that, would it cut both ways? If we acknowledge that some beliefs are clearly fictitious, and that figures into the explanation, what about the possibility that some beliefs might be true? Richard Dawkins says, for example, if he had a time machine, he'd go back and sample Jesus' DNA, look at his, the X chromosome, the Y chromosome, figure out who it came from, and disprove the birth of birth. Well, of course, we don't have access to a time machine. But we do have access to inferential arguments about the plausibility of certain occurrences. So we can't take a time machine and go back and see its illusion. But we can make arguments for and against the incidents of the human. And one of the questions, and I don't have an answer to that, but should those kinds of arguments figure into the causal accounts of why people believe them? Okay, so here we go. We have to say just a quick comment on what is religion. Now, this, I don't want to define this, but that is a lifestyle. But I do want to point out that there are different traditions within naturalistic explanations of religion that choose different definitions of religion. So, for example, most of the cognitive science accounts, which Alistair McGrath referred to last night, choose the definition of religion along these lines. The minimum definition of religion is belief in spiritual beings. That is to say, they choose a definition of religion that emphasizes belief in supernatural beings. Many of the population genetic approaches choose a more sociologically nuanced definition of religion, along the lines of Clifford Geertz's definition, and a system of symbols which acts to establish a powerful, pervasive, and long-lasting moods and motivations in men by formulating conceptions of the general order of existence. Those are very different definitions. And in psychology, a famous psychologist is named Gene Evelyn Hutchinson, and he pointed out that the most, I'm just glad to put this under Hutchinson's dip, but he pointed out the most important decision an psychologist ever makes is where to get out of the call. And similarly, that is to say, what community you choose to study is going to influence your conclusions. And similarly, how we define religion is going to influence our conclusions about what causes it. And first, and secondly, it involves a suite of characteristics. There are cognitive dispositions and commitments, affective and noumenal experiences, individual behaviors, social structures, ecological life histories, that is to say, the fall of the course of phenomenal growth through what David would call the groupization of charisma. There are evolutionary trajectories over thousands of years. Religion seems to change on our planet. All of these things together suggest that there are myths and possibly conflicting ideologies of religion. And then lastly, there's a huge planetary landscape of how we would want to explain. There are genetic explanations, made the cover of Time magazine a while back. There are neurological explanations, cognitive explanations, the analysis we talked about these last night, and social explanations of religion. And these exist on a landscape, a continuum of the scale of explanation. They exist on a continuum of causal explanation. The possible causes, what's the immediate cause for a particular cognitive event, the ultimate explanations in terms of origin or function. And this is where evolutionary explanations currently exist. Now, the reason I'm doing all this, and I'm actually going to skip over this next portion, there are a number of evolutionary explanations which can emphasize both the origin and the maintenance, the point that we made earlier. There are literally hundreds of ways to come up to the task of explaining religion, and therefore, it might be just a little bit overly ambitious for the book to have started this field to have been humbly entitled Religion Explained, Pascal Boyer. In fact, he did explain it. What he proposed was a proximal cognitive explanation for the qualities of some kinds of religious beliefs. Now, what I want to do in the time remaining is actually survey the three major evolutionary proposals for religious beliefs. First of all, our cognitive spandrel account. Spandrel is a feature of a structure that is intrinsic to its structure but doesn't perform any function. The word was first proposed actually by Stephen Jay Gould some time ago. Cognitive spandrel accounts simply say that religion doesn't perform any useful function or make any contribution to human flourishing. It's just a byproduct of other cognitive abilities. Freud's notion of emotional complication, which is picked up by other workers, is one example. A second example is that many workers attribute religious belief and practices to actually the same kind of cognitive distortions that result in obsessive compulsive disorder. But the dominant player, and I'm not going to say much about these, the dominant player is the hyperactive agency detector hypothesis. Pascal Boyer, John Aitken, and Justin Barrett, a Christian who's at Oxford right now, are jointly investigating this idea. It's actually pretty straightforward. It begins with the assertion that there are innate capacities in human beings to detect agents. And in fact, there is an innate intuitive physics and an intuitive psychology that can be demonstrated by infants as early as 5 months old. They can distinguish the trajectory of objects. They can apparently distinguish between agents and inanimate objects. And secondly, the agent concepts tend to have a certain robustness to them. That is to say, attributing agency is hyperactive, is biased toward false qualities. You tend to see agents when they're not there. And very early on, we attribute to agents certain magnified properties. Immortality, the great survivability, omniscience, omniperception. For example, and I want to thank Justin Barrett for these slides, people attribute the agency very easily to God. That's why video games are there. isn't apparent, the process chasing that social intentional agent, the 5-month-old infant's discriminated mutations in mass random movement, by 9 months, dependents can tell, can become amused when the chaser becomes the chasee. Adults describe that these events by attributing beliefs, desires, and oftentimes gender to objects like that. Children were asked which entities, mother, god, bear, elephant, snake, could see what's inside of a closed box. And a three-year-old assumed that all living entities knew what was in a closed box. By 5, only God knew. And the same thing for super-perceiving, seeing in the dark. 3-year-olds think that everybody can see in the dark. By 6, only Kitty and God. So a fascinating experiment, a mouse was fed to an elephant, to a python inside a box. And children were asked, what happened to the mouse? And they said, the python ate it. Is the python still there? Yes. Is the mouse still there? No. Is the mouse still alive? Yes. So, what's our assessment of these? First of all, these are some fascinating empirical confirmations of the way we detect agents and the notion that magnified properties of agents, omniscience and immortality, appear to be innate. And these 3-year-olds, by the way, were asked in religious and non-religious households. On the other hand, to call them products, byproducts versus products, is actually a little bit difficult. In none of these studies has there been a demonstration that these cognitive capacities did not perform and make a contribution to human flourishing. In fact, the notion of byproduct in scientific terminology is a little bit difficult because it suggests that we know what something is for. In chemistry, we just have products of reactions. We don't have byproducts. We only have byproducts once we become engineers and we design a reaction to make something. And lastly, we have what the number of people call the Mickey Mouse problem. That is to say that even if these are helpful understandings, they don't actually distinguish the salient quality of a religious attribute, which is a sacred property to a transcendent agent. They don't distinguish between our inclination to believe in God or Mickey Mouse as a food fairy. In terms of religious implications, at face value, there's some options for natural theology. There's a strong program that some have included in natural theology, like Andrew Newberg, for example, who argue that because we can trust the fact that our fundamental cognitive dispositions have some match to what's out there. Some people use this as an argument for God's existence. I think that's a little dubious, but there's a weaker version, which just simply says, if there were a God, this is actually pretty much what we might expect, particularly for scriptural revelation about the innate disposition to believe in transcendent purposes or agents behind these systems. Now, there's also, emerging natural state theology, which argues that because these concepts emerge from a hyperactive or bias towards a false positive attribution, that there is an unreliability of religious beliefs. Well, the problem with this is twofold. First of all, we haven't really determined that the agency detected divide new hyperactive. It's for sure imprecise, but we don't have a distribution of error. And the second thing is that religious conviction may be contributed to by our, if there is such a thing as an agency detector, it may be contributed to by it, but that certainly isn't what forms and sustains religious belief. In fact, the data I just showed you suggests that human beings are always parsing the true and the untrue. That's why by 5-year-olds, infants had figured out that the dog in the city doesn't know what's in the box, if the box is there. And over the course of the human lifespan, and then after that, over the course of millennia, theological reflection and rational deliberation and assessment has been part of the honing of religious belief. So I'm not sure that this is a good argument in itself. Unless I want to point out that a number of these movements assume that religious belief is pathological. So the Yale psychologist Paul Bloom, in a very widely read essay in the Atlantic of some months ago, talked about religious belief as being a byproduct gone wrong. Not just suggesting it's a byproduct, but it's a byproduct which is doing disservice, injuring them. And actually hasn't been demonstrated. And Paul has reconsidered this attribution, although a number of people have thought it was been enough. And lastly, we might want to ask, if it's a standard, if it's a byproduct, why do people invest so intensively in religious belief? So in an article in Science, just a few weeks ago, actually, Paul Bloom just mentioned this, argued that these dispositions are innate. And then, in discussing this, kind of phrased this theory under the title, Why do adolescents believe in God? This question that I'm raising might be phrased the opposite. Why do adolescents wish their parents didn't believe in God? That is to say, there's a history in religious traditions of dramatically positive adjustments, which Handel theories were not comprehend. So, onto the scene comes mimetic theory, a theory of mimetic changes. Again, Alistair talked about this a little last night. I won't say much because, although publicly prominent, it actually doesn't figure very heavily in the scientific approaches to religion. But the proposal basically is this. And this is kind of interesting. The proposal is that humans, and only humans, have a dual inherited input into their behavior. E.O. Wilson, 20 years ago, proposed the notion of a genetic leash with constrained behavior. And in terms of mimetic theory, the leash is broken. And it's broken specifically by other informational inputs, means, which can subvert genetic self-interest. So Joseph Lotrito talks about conceptions of a cultural nature that force the self-serving thrust of the gene, the sole principle among them. And by that he means the belief in transcendent entities of any kind. To be thought of as the kernel of an internalized morality, reinforced by fictitious forces, even believe it is, artificial forces, whereby some humans are led to subordinate the genetic fitness and the self-interest in general to the fitness and interest of others. Now, lastly, when it comes to religious means, most mean theories argue that religious faith is a viral means that infects us like a virus infects our body for its own transmission, but in opposition to our own blood. So Dawkins famously says, faith is one of the world's great evils, comparable to the smallpox, but more difficult to eradicate. And people who suffer from this disease, the patients, typically find themselves impelled by some deep inner conviction that something is true or right or virtuous. We doctors refer to such a belief as faith. And it's often hoped that doctors and scientists will cure people of the disease of believing that something is true or right or virtuous. Now, how can we assess these ideas? First of all, I want to say there's a stunning attribution of unique biological transcendence to human beings. Then, that demonstration itself says we have built in desire to reproduce and do pretty much whatever it takes to achieve this goal, reproduce. But we also have trees. And the ability to transcend our genetic materials. This fact does make a difference. Now, he's earlier argued that we don't, so there's a little incoherence here. That's a stunning recognition, actually. And Richard Dawkins, way back in The Selfish Gene, said, we have the power to defy the selfish genes of our birth, something that has no place in nature, something that has never existed before in the whole history of the world. Actually, this may be conferring more uniqueness than any theological assessments might want to confer. Theological tradition wants to see human beings just rooted in the creation. Nevertheless, this constitutes a dramatic acknowledgement that is not in any way an explanation. what a meaning is, how it is that it's achieved its infiltration into the human cognitive apparatus, and once there, how on earth it was leveraged against genetic inclinations. There are no proposals of any kind. And in the 20 years since the idea was developed, actually, there haven't been any empirical studies. Actually, that's not true. There have been some empirical studies of genetic transmission on the internet. But of course, it's not clear there what's being transmitted. A virus can be transmitted on the internet without any consciousness. In fact, it's not even clear that the meme idea is naturalistic, at least in terms of the way that we describe it to begin with. Observable regularities and testable causalism. And lastly, of course, the whole distinction between a parasitic and a beneficent meaning is questioning. There actually hasn't been anything other than anecdotal attribution of the destructive effects of religion. I think that's an interesting question in itself, whether or not we use the meme idea of the distinction between the beneficent effects. The life-promoting effects and the destructive effects of religion is an interesting question. I share my personal conviction is I don't think we gain much scientifically, but for that matter, theologically, by posing it as an either-or dichotomy. Clearly, there are toxic religious beliefs, there are life-enhancing religious beliefs. Religious beliefs vary from culture to culture, and even over the course of the last an individual lifetime. So that's probably not an either-or question. But the last tradition I want to describe that it's a tradition on the question, is the adaptationist. The adaptationist tradition argues contra genetic bias. That religion is adaptive. That in fact it's fundamental to human flourishing. Many of the people making these arguments are not religious believers. Nevertheless, that's the direction we're going. And here's how the proposal works. There are a number of different approaches to this, but the dominant one goes like this. Religion is a uniquely human adaptive solution to a fundamental challenge of organismic function. Organismic function, in fact, the very word organism comes from organization. A challenge to organismic function is cooperation. Co at the level of genes cooperating with one another, cells in our body, organs in our body, individuals and social organizations, is famously vulnerable to disruptive defects. Even a simple cooperative interaction like this, symbiosis between a tuner fish, in the case of rats, and a grouper, is open to defection. The rat could take a little bit of the grouper's gum. And on the other hand, some fish that get their gums clean are carnivorous. What's to prevent them from just gobbling up the rat? And this can be modeled famously in the physical domain. It can be shown that the best for each to cooperate, but in fact, not knowing what the others will do, the Nash equilibrium, the point at which both parties are driven to, is mutual protection. Now, what's the solution to this? There are a number of mathematical solutions, but an empirically observed solution, actually. The problem is the factor. The solution is policing. Social policing or punishment. We see this, by the way, in our bodies. The immune system is a policing system. We see this in social insects, just recently, policing individuals in the ant colony. Policing the factors of cheese. And really quite exciting paper in Nature a while back. Here, Sarah demonstrated punishment performs a crucial policing function in human interaction. Of course, we know this at the level of social organization. That's what police are for. What Sarah found was that humans actually engage in altruistic punishment. They extend their resources to punish in greater amounts than they're likely to recoup by bringing the defector in line. And it's not out of balance. It's not you burn me and I'm going to indulge in the pleasure of young vengeance. The amount of resources extended are proportional not to the harm I suffer, but to the degree of social contraction, the degree of fairness contraction. That's really a fascinating proposal for the stabilization of cooperation, but it involves a problem. Just a few months ago, in Nature, there's a letter pointing this out. The problem is the problem of infinite regrowth. If punishment takes resources, what could prevent free riders on them? On punishment. And here's where the theory of religion comes. Religion is understood to involve cognitive internalization of cosmic sanctity. The belief in heaven and hell, the belief in karma, the belief simply that the universe is morally structured in such a way as to involve intrinsic rewards for good behavior and intrinsic penalties for bad behavior. The belief in any transcendent moral purpose for the cosmos, if internalized, solves this problem of secondary effects. First of all, because punishment doesn't cause anything. Nobody has to hand it up. And second of all, if it's internalized, you never escape, internalized, you don't escape detection. You're your own detective. This is a little bit facetious, but the behavior of Dominic Johnson is put this way in Typical Prisoner's Dilemma. Defecting when you're cooperated with is not an option. Heaven becomes an anti-equilibrium. That is to say, cooperation becomes an anti-equilibrium. We can launch that sort of our Catholic theology. If you cooperate with those who cooperate with you, Jesus says that this is the same. What credit is that to you? We can tax collectors do that. But if you cooperate with those who do that, then you've got heaven and sainthood. I'd like to suggest that this could be also modified for maybe a more mean-spirited fundamentalist theology. But now, is there any empirical evidence that this actually goes on? And there actually is growing empirical evidence that this is important. A number of social psychological experiments, when people are given what's called a supernatural prompt, if you just talk about God before you do a game theory experiment, even if the person doesn't believe in God, there are higher levels of cooperation. The anthropologist Richard Sosis has looked at the longevity of religious and secular communities and found that religious communities, and by communities, mean communitarian social organizations, vastly outnumber secular ones. He had to throw out the Hutterites in this analysis. The Hutterites then are. There is no attribute. We're still going after 200 years. But lastly, within there's the problem of tertiary defection. Tertiary defection would be a situation in which the person doesn't believe in cognitive defection. They're unbelievers, or in common parlance, right. So the sanction hasn't been internalized. What should you do there? The notion is behavioral display for costly practices. By the way, this is a long-standing Darwinian approach to things like the cocktail that is beginning to apply to religious practice now. Proposed about 15 years ago by an anthropologist named Bill Irons, but we're just beginning to amass rather substantial cross-cultural comparative data. For example, this social community, just looking at religious communities, we found that the longevity is proportional to the duration of costly requirements, the number of costly requirements in those communities. And we've looked at this rate of resisting in particular. Okay, and lastly, you can have a quaternary event. That's to say, hypocrites who simply counted the cost of what it would take to gain your religious credibility for an insinuation into a community. The evolutionary biologist Richard Alexander says we're as good as it pays to be, we're as bad as we can get away with. And in fact, in the biblical tradition, one of Jesus and the prophetic tradition's primary emphases was against the public display of religiosity by hypocritical believers. What's the solution to this? It's what the evolutionary theory of the neighborhood tradition in Randy Hessen calls authentic. This is suggestive to them. Where there are internalized not only beliefs, but internalized benefits to believing and cause to hypocritical profession. The union of mission, practice, and affect in what we might consider to be eudaimonia. To truly believe and to act on the basis of that belief would have organismic benefits. Now, is there any evidence that that is the case? Well, there's a rich legacy, though a controversial legacy, of the relationship between religious beliefs and human health. Interestingly, a few years ago, before he died, Ed Larson found that religious belief is also negatively correlated with human health, in cases where people claim not to be living up to their religious beliefs. And most recently, Randy Hefty and Stephanie Brown at the University of Michigan went back to some of these studies of longevity, where people would have to live longer with terminal diseases that they're involved in a support group. And they asked this question: who's living longer? Is it the people controlling for initial state of health who are doing the giving or the receiving? And they were surprised to find, if you're primarily dependent, receiving, control for health, your mortality is actually higher. And if you're a giver, your mortality is lower. The first beginning of the empirical confirmation is that it really might be better to give than receive. And that this notion of internal negation may have empirical ones. So I want to conclude here with a couple of very quick comments. First of all, I want to argue that there's a need for explanatory pluralism. None of these accounts are sufficient. They may all be necessary. And in fact, they can all work together, although the community is unpolarized right now with people duking it out, who's right, who's wrong. We could have an innate disposition to receive certain means, which might have genuinely beneficial outcomes for the believers. There's a possibility for consilience here, but I also want to exhort some caution here. Cognitive theories right now affirm what most Christians have always believed, that a strong innate sense for knowledge of transcendent dimensions to existence. On the other hand, they also point out that there are cognitive biases involved. Mimetic notions point out that, well, if you know the truth is not setting free. In a sense, I'm being a little hyperbolic here, but they point out that ideas have the genuine capacity to transform human behavior. But they also warn us that ideas can be epidemiologically rather than rationally transmitted. There's a high correlation between what household or what family you grow up on in, and what religious ideas you happen to espouse. Adaptationist notion. I really welcome the idea that somehow religious belief may have intrinsic benefits. But the notion of a biological adaptation is a slippery one. So there are many things that might be adapted at the corporate level. That are simply wrong, metaphysically wrong, and morally wrong. So the fact that something is adaptive doesn't necessarily make it either right or desirable. Okay. So, finish in 1 minute. What about the notion of functional explanation? Is that an enemy of religious belief? There are some who would say that if you provide, and I began at the quote from Carnegie Hill, that if you provide a functional explanation, it dismisses or subverts the truth of a proposition of religious belief. There's actually no demonstration that that's the case. And in fact, it's at least consilient is the truth. But there is a more profound challenge. It's the challenge not to the truth of the belief, but to the warrant of the belief. Last sentence here. In a powerful essay, Biology, Philosophy, Garden, and Nihilistic Idea, Alex Rosenberg says, if our best theory of why people believe T does not require that T is true, then there are no grounds to believe that T is true. That's actually a challenge that I think needs to be taken seriously. And as an off-the-cuff response, I would simply say that the challenge is valid, but we're not there yet. We don't have an account that exhaustively explains why people believe T to be true or God to exist. And lastly, what about our assurance that our own personal assurance and our witness to the world? Well, Jesus says this: by this will the world know that you are my disciples, that you declare how the fine tuning of the cosmological process, the 10th of the 28th, demonstrates my existence and how epidemiological theories and the meta transition fail to them themselves. Of course, he doesn't claim this. He claims that by this will the world know you, my disciples, that you have love for one another. So I would argue that the best demonstration of the viability of religious belief is to let those beliefs have their proper fruition in the life.